good afternoon. So last time, we started by mentioning one reason why people might write code where they think they make sure there aren't buffer overflows, but in fact still have buffer overflows. A big reason for that is integer overflow or underflow, where they do some computation to see, am I going to exceed the bounds of this buffer? And it turns out that that computation can wrap around, and therefore the comparison they do at the end of it doesn't always check what they're hoping to check. Then after that, looking into buffer overflows happening, and building on our prior work of how we can exploit them by overwriting the return address, we looked at a defense targeted at the idea of overwriting return addresses, known as stack canaries, where the idea is we just put a value before the return address that would act as a notifier if the return address was probably changed as a result of a buffer overflow that overwrote going from below the return address to the return address, because this stack canary value would be in between, and we check it before we actually ran the return instruction. Now, this isn't perfect, and one issue we mentioned was information leaks, that sometimes programs output parts of memory. So we saw an example of this later on with sort of printf. If you pass printf a bunch of conversion specifiers, it reads from the stack. That probably could end up including a stack canary. We saw that if we have uninitialized values, those could end up being values that were previously on the stack or in some register, and that could give us the value of a stack canary. So, probably. Or we could have bugs where we could overwrite a pointer and get the value pointed to by that pointer, which would also be sort of useful if we figured out the address of a stack canary. Another issue that prevents stack canaries from being fully protective is that not all of the overwrites we're going to find are going to be contiguous. It's not always the case that we're going to go from our buffer to the return address. Sometimes we'll be able to skip around because maybe we'll supply an index to write to, and that index won't be correctly bounce checked. And we can just choose the index that corresponds to where the return address is, where it would be if the buffer were bigger based on this address, and avoid overwriting the stack canary entirely. Then, after looking at this defense, we looked at a different type of generic attack. So stack canaries were about stack smashing, this generic attack where we overwrite our return address and turn that into running code. We mentioned format string exploits, which were another generic attack where we take something like a printf call, where the argument is controlled by the attacker, and we point out, well, what does that let the attacker do? And it turns out the answer is pretty much anything. So they can use this to read the stack, because when printf needs to use more than enough arguments, it's going to go to the stack for the arguments. And even though the printf call in the C code only had one argument, printf doesn't know that. It just sees, oh, there's this many percent signs in my first argument, therefore there must be that many arguments. So it can read from the stack and output that for us. And more troublingly, there's a conversion specifier that writes to memory, which is percent %n, and by carefully constructing a format string, we can actually just write values pretty much anywhere in memory and pretty much any value we like. So this turns into something we can use to, say, overwrite a return address directly. Now, if we're going to be looking at bugs where we can overwrite arbitrary addresses, and format string exploits are not going to be the only type, we're going to talk about some other examples later today, we're going to be concerned about not just return addresses, but there's other interesting targets that we might want to overwrite. So we had return addresses we could overwrite. We could also overwrite linking stubs. So we mentioned that we did this global offset table lookup as part of dynamic linking. And there's also maybe some other pointers that are in memory that we could overwrite. And we saw that we had these virtual function tables. That we are doing something like inheritance, either because we wrote like C++ code with virtual functions or because we want to re-implement that ourselves in C, we're typically going to have tables of function pointers, and we can overwrite those function pointers to point to code we want to run. We're going to continue finishing up looking at this idea of tables of function pointers that we would be used for inheritance, which comes up all the time in object-oriented code that's compiled today. But before I move on, questions about things we covered last time?
Is it I don't know whether you prefer people ask about the quiz in office hours or in lecture, but just what the person on the second in the comments said, which is, could we go over question 3 in the quiz?
Okay. And there's also a question, is the homework still tentative? And I hope I marked it as not tentative because I thought that was something I did. Currently, that is not something I did. It's not supposed to be tentative. You should be able to start the homework and not expect it to change, which is the main... So I will update that. So again, quiz question 3 is the other question. So, sure. So quiz question 3 asking... So which of these information leaks would be most useful to perform a buffer overflow despite stack canaries? So so probably if it's a buffer overflow, we're probably relying on it on, you know, not having something where we can just write to an arbitrary place in memory, unless we happen to know the address of something special that would let us sort of skip over things. So the most straightforward thing to do would be to write the value of the stack canary. And this is what C would let us get, is that this could contain the actual stack canary value, because that would be what the function had put there. These other things, so this stack pointer would help us find where the return address is, but that's only going to be useful if we have some way of overwriting that skips over and goes directly to the return address value, which is not the main difficulty that stack canaries are going to create for us. Similarly, this address here, so B, would not help us because we probably already actually know that. Or if it's location of a library function, like, it doesn't really help us because, you know, that's not something we're going to be able to overwrite, and that's not something that we want to actually run. And A doesn't really help us because the C++ object isn't there anymore. And we have the value location of a V table, which maybe that would be useful for overwriting if we could overwrite it. But again, to do that, we'd need some sort of exploit that lets us write to an arbitrary memory location. And if we have that, probably the easiest way of exploiting that is actually just writing directly to some known function pointer address, which we might be able to determine more statically. But I guess the confusion here is people assume we needed to figure out the address to overwrite. But my assumption here in writing this question, which I guess I should have made clearer, is that we had a contiguous buffer overwrite, that we didn't have the option of skipping over things. Because if we had that sort of option, if we had something like a format string exploit where we could just write to an arbitrary location, you know, then yes, the problem would be discovering the location to write to, but that's not the sort of scenario I was assuming. But maybe I need to reconsider the key for this question because I wasn't as explicit with that as I should have been. So question is, how does knowing the value of the stack canary help us if the function is already returned? Isn't the canary randomly generated each execution? So generally not. And the reason for this is just a performance one, that if we wanted to generate a new random value execution, that would increase the overhead of stack canaries a bunch. So usually the stack canary is generated each time we run a program. It uses one stack canary all the time. Is that, or at least for each thread. Does that answer that question? And that's a good question. Yeah, so indeed, we could like make this harder by generating a new stack canary each time, but that's a that would make the overhead higher. And I'll take Enlan's question.
Yeah. I guess for C, could we, was that also sort of assuming that the part of the stack that we, the part of the used function stack contained the canary, the stack canary, like, can we assume that?
It's the only one which could contain the canary was my intention in the writing of this question.
That makes sense.
All the others definitely do not contain the canary value. And Nasrat? No, that was your question? Okay.
No. Sorry about that. I don't remember if you went over why D is not the answer. I'm assuming that's because you get the value of the stack pointer points to the base of the stack, which isn't really as important as knowing where the canary is.
So the issue with D is that this would be information where if we had an exploit that let us write to an arbitrary memory location, this would be great, right? We could figure out where a return address is. But that's more than having a buffer overflow.
So that would help you with address randomization, not so much...
Yes, so this would help you with random address randomization. That would be great for that. So this would be great for address randomization. This B might also be good for address randomization. And A would also probably be good for address randomization, but that's not what we're trying to defeat here. Yeah, but yeah, I guess a key confusion is that my intention was like a bunch of these things would help a lot with address randomization. But if we don't have address randomization, then actually like these values here, A, B, and D, we kind of already know. Which is another way of thinking about it. Does that help explain things? So it's not that these aren't useful information leaks. They're just information leaks which are useful because they help us defeat address randomization, not stack canaries. So question is, couldn't we use the stack pointer to skip the stack canary on a buffer overflow? So yes, that would be helpful for that. But if we don't have address randomization, we don't need any other information to do that. We just know... Oh, if there's no address randomization, we know the stack, we can compute where the stack pointer is going to be.
And then I just was curious. So when we talk about in last class, when we talked about the non-contiguous overwrite that was not necessarily like an arbitrary overwrite, but it just it was slide 26 or so of the.
You had a non-contiguous overwrite where you could choose an index that was too big but not arbitrarily big.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Does that help anything with, I don't know.
So that we could use to defeat stack canaries, but we wouldn't actually need to know the stack canary value or the stack or anything special about the stack pointer value really to overwrite the return address. We might need to know something to know what to overwrite it with, but we wouldn't, but for the part of skipping over the stack canary, we just know, oh, the stack canary is, you know, these bytes, let's just use a value that is bigger than that as far as where the array is. So hopefully that explains things. And a question on the last question, why does a value less than 8 create an overflow? And that's because of this. So what's going to happen in this question here is that our size here is an unsigned int. And when we subtract 8 from an unsigned int, that's 7, we're going to get a big positive number that Efreet will heavily try to read that much for us. And question for number two, would I accept 55 as the off by one error? Probably yes. I have to go through the wrong answers, obviously, because I did not have time to do that in the 30 minutes since this quiz was due. Other questions about quiz or things we covered last time? Now I think I'll try to remember to write on the quiz that the other ones help with for the information leak question, since that definitely was a big point of confusion, pointing out the other ones help with ASLR but not Stack Canaries per se. And consider whether I want to give credit for some additional answers or not. Okay. So back to talking about virtual function tables. So we mentioned we had this pattern to implement virtual functions. So, in C++ and, might do something similar in other object-oriented languages where our objects will contain at the beginning a pointer to a table of functions. Are these slides online? I was hoping they would be, but probably not going to fix that now. They will be online after this lecture, or possibly during this lecture when I have a question to ask. So we have a vtable pointer, which points to a bunch of function pointers. And the idea is that if we have different types of, say, input streams, they'll have different function pointers. And as far as doing a call, we do this thing where the compiler will look up the function pointer using that vtable and therefore call the appropriate subclasses method. And also arrange to make sure that the object is set up correctly so that vtable pointer is created as part of constructing an object of a subclass of input stream. So we have sort of two things to we can think about as far as how we, actually overwrite this. And sort of one option is that we could try to overwrite these pointers directly, that we could figure out where is this get pointer, let's replace it with our own pointer. Another option is we can say, we can just try to overwrite, so we can overwrite the get pointer, we can try to overwrite this pointer and point to our own array of pointers that the attacker makes, and that points to, the code the attacker wants to run. And often the second option is going to be easier because, the vtable pointer is more likely to be near our buffer. So considering that scenario, let's look at sort of an example where that's what we're going to want to do. So I'm saying here, I should admit, that if we have a buffer that grows downwards in this diagram, so this is 0 in the buffer and this is 100, I probably should be more consistent with how I've drawn stacks. I'm sorry about that. The idea is that we have a buffer overflow here, which can overwrite this vtable pointer of the next element in the array. So how can we use this to actually cause code to execute when later on we know, let's say after array one is filling, object array zero's buffer is filled, we know object array one.foo is going to be called. And I guess actually this is not, this is actually a bad example, but for reasons that have to do with how C++ works and not what we're actually trying to cover. So assume that this is a virtual call. Assume that this uses the vtable. So a problem with this is that this might actually not use the vtable. But if this uses the vtable, what would we want to do? And for this to use the vtable, probably there would have to be some extra indirection because we'd have to like pass a pointer to something which didn't know what subclass it was. Slides should be linked up now for people waiting for that. Okay, and looks like, okay. We have a variety. So it looks like we have agreement on the first part, not the rest. Yeah, and I guess to be more realistic on how this call would happen is that if we're doing like the way this virtual call would happen is that we do like we convert the object to a pointer to a superclass and then do a foo call on that superclass pointer. Okay, so give another 20 seconds. So we're going to overwrite this vtable pointer. And for this question, it's not the order I asked it in, but where I start thinking is, what do I want this vtable pointer to point to? And if we look at what the original code expects it to point to, it expects it to point to more pointers, pointers to the actual code for vulnerable class foo and bar. So we, when we replace it, are going to need to imitate that. So we want to make it end up pointing to something that looks the same, but actually goes to our correct, actually goes to code we want. So as far as what we want here, we do not want the shell code because, well, it's not looking for code here. It's looking for a pointer to code. So that's not going to work out. So we want to set up some place we control to have pointers to code. So we have two options here, and we can either put our code in B in the, at the beginning of the buffer or at offset 50 in the buffer, given if we want to use the options given. So, sorry, not our code. We can put our pointers at the beginning or offset 50. So we're going to have to put either B or C. And I'm going to assume we've chosen B. Look at that. So if we said that B has our pointer for the foo method, we want to say, oh no, the foo method you call is not the vulnerable classes one, it's my special subclass, my execute malicious code subclass. So that's where we want the pointer to our shellcode. So here we want in that case, the pointer to the shell code. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to decide, well, where can I put the shell code? I have some space in buffer 50, so I'll have C as my pointer to the shell code, which means A would be my shell code. And this is assuming I've chosen B for the VTable pointer. And we'd swap these if I chose C. So questions about how I came up with that answer?
Why do either buffer 0 or buffer 50 have to be a pointer to the shellcode? Why can't the VTable pointer point directly to shellcode?
Because the way that the VTable is set up is that it's a table of more pointers. Because if we think of like what the compiler wants one pointer it can store that tells it how to call all the methods. So that pointer needs to point to more pointers, one for each method. And, you know, conceptually, the compiler, maybe it could put the function pointers directly in the object, but that would mean that every object would have, like, an extra pointer because it has an extra method. And we think of, like, you know, IOStream would have, like, 20 extra pointers, and that would not be acceptable for, you know, space. Does that make sense? Or answer your question?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. And I think that's the question being asked. So why did we have to have this indirect pointer, this pointer to a pointer? And that's because the VTable pointer is kind of a pointer to more pointers. And that's because of the structure and compiler setup. Yeah, and I guess a condition that I didn't specify well enough in this question is that for this to work, this call here needs to actually use the VTable. And basically, compilers will only do that in cases where the compiler doesn't know whether or not a subclass would be involved. So here, you know, if it was actually called like directly on this array, probably it wouldn't use a VTable. But if like we got a pointer to an array element and that, you know, was cast to a superclass, then, the compiler was worried there were subclasses of this, then it would have to use the VTable because maybe it was a subclass object. Follow-up questions? Other things? Okay, so let's consider probably one of the more common ways we get arbitrary memory overwrite. So we have this arbitrary memory overwrite. How does that happen? So one way that happens is when we have pointers on the stack. So here I have a scenario where I have a buffer and I have a value and a pointer on the stack, and we overflow the buffer and then write a value to that pointer. And let's say, you know, that this pointer and this value were located after the buffer on the stack. So in this case, addresses go up, so buffer 0 is here, buffer 100 is here. And if we overflow the end of the buffer, we're going to overwrite the value and the pointer. So let's say we wanted to use this to skip over our stack canary. Well, what we do is we'd make the pointer point to our return address and the value point to our shellcode that would hypothetically be in the buffer. And as a result of this last statement here, the program would helpfully assign the return address, you know, using that pointer to point to our machine code. questions on sort of this indirection of you overwriting a pointer to overwrite another pointer. So in this example, I've shown it us doing this to kind of do roundabout stack smashing, but usually that's not actually the easiest solution. So for example, if we know we have, say, the global offset table, which has an entry for printf, maybe the easiest thing to do would be to make printf point somewhere else, like right in this buffer. So later on when the program calls printf, it ends up running our machine code. Questions about what happens here. So a question, isn't 100 bytes not a lot to work with? It's not a lot, but it's plenty for an attacker to write machine code. In particular, note that someone attacking this could write machine code whose purpose is to load more machine code if it really wasn't enough space for what they wanted to do. Question is, wouldn't the buffer get overwritten at some point by another function? So that is a possibility. And you know, when you choose to do this would depend on what other functions are used between whatever, you know, are likely to do in between. And probably what you'd hope is that maybe like the bottom of the buffer gets overfilled, but you could make the pointer point to the middle of the buffer and that would be okay. But it would depend on the program. Does that answer that question? Oh. Aren't we worried about this buffer being overwritten before printf is called? Okay. So this scenario here, this idea of overwriting pointers to overwrite more pointers comes up a lot in real programs. Now, but this particular version of it doesn't actually happen very much, as far as I've seen, because compilers can do a little bit of work and make that not work. So for example, if you compile that function with GCC, this is likely the sort of stack layout you'll get. That GCC will carefully put the buffer next to the stack canary, so if you overflow it to increasing addresses, you don't hit the pointer or the value. And you might say, well, if compilers can just do this, why are we worried about this attack? And the answer is that it comes up in other types of overflows, in particular with structs. With a struct, the compiler kind of has to keep it in the order it's specified. So here I have a buffer which is followed by a pointer, and that's just how it has to be laid out in memory. The compiler is not going to try to change that generally. In fact, C has a very strict rules that the compiler for C and C++ is not allowed to change the order. So active value will be after values. So we can do that here. If we can overflow values in the struct, we can overwrite this active value pointer. And another example where this comes up is with global variables. Let's say I have a global pointer and a global array. It could end up being the case that when the compiler decide and the linker decide where to put these global variables, that it ends up that the buffer is followed by the pointer. That happens pretty frequently, especially if they're like not actually in the same file. Questions about this overwriting a pointer, these cases. Okay. So the question is, why don't we have something kind of like a stack canary? We'll get to that. But But you, so one idea you might have is, oh, we could just put something here that would help us detect overwrites. Now, doing it something like a stat canary is tricky because we need to like check it every time we access current command, and that would be high overhead. But there's some versions of this idea which are more workable. And we'll look at them probably later today. But first, I'd like to go back to like just exploiting the scenario we have here of, well, you know, how do we use this overwrite? And so far, I've shown you that, oh, we're going to overwrite things to point to machine code that the attacker writes in memory. But that's not the only option. That when we find a function pointer, we don't have to make it point to our code. Sometimes there are other places we can point it to. That, you know, rather than pointing it to that, let's just find a useful function in the program and point it there. And we might say, well, that's great. That's a lot easier. I didn't have to write shellcode. But what kind of program is going to have this do useful stuff function? And the answer, as we'll learn later in the semester, is pretty much every program. It's kind of a problem. Though it's often a little complicated. I'm going to start with the simple case. And later on, probably next time or either Thursday or next Tuesday, we'll talk about the more general case. But I'll give one particular example of how the program could have a useful function for us to run. And I'm going to start with this C library function called system. It runs a command that's given as its first argument. So if we set the return address to point there, it's going to look in its first argument, and this is the RDI register because of the calling convention, and run that as a program. That lets us do pretty much anything. And this is part of the C standard library, so any program that loads the C standard library, that's linked to it, is going to have it in its memory. We just need to figure out what the address is. So we could say, do that. So for example, on Linux, the LDD command tells you where, if address randomization is disabled, where a library will be loaded. We can look up where the system function is in libc, add these two together. We get the address it's like going to be loaded at. There's tools for other OSs, so we have the address of it. And we could just make our pointer point to that function, assuming RDI happens to have the right value. Now, this is the big assumption, and we'll talk, you know, sometime later about, well, surely, you know, this won't always work because you can't make it so you always have the right value in RDI and so on. Turns out the answer is going to be, well, sorry, you probably can. But we'll get to why later. But we'll look at this case with an example of sort of a practical case study of a buffer overflow that uses this principle. But before I get to that, sort of questions on sort of why this is useful. So the question is, what's the glibc part? So this is part of the standard library, which is loaded, and it's loaded by the dynamic linker. So LDD is a program which tells me what would the dynamic linker do with this file. And it says, oh, the dynamic linker is going to load this library at this library at this address, and so on. And then I look up, okay, where is the system function in this library file to figure out its address. LDD is the will dynamic linker do. Okay. So I'm going to look at a case study, and this was a exploit of a buffer overflow in the network time protocol daemon that was shipped with OS X at some point in time in the past. And it had one of these pointer subterfuge, this overwrite a pointer to overwrite more pointers exploits with some global variables. And the bug was in this memmove function. So this is a copy this many. So this copies to this destination from this source this number of bytes. And the bug was that this number of bytes was not properly bounds checked to fit in the buffer that this pointer data PT pointed to. And conveniently, the buffer was a global array that this data pointer pointed to, which the pointer was after the array. So the way that Stafford Roger exploited this was by overwriting the pointer to the buffer to point somewhere else. Because if you just go enough there, you'll actually overwrite that pointer, and then using the next time this runs to actually overwrite that somewhere else. So the first step is going to be to make this pointer point to somewhere else, and the second step is that this is going to run twice. Why is it going to run twice? Because this is a network program that's reading input from the network, writing things like this, reading more input from the network, writing more things like this, and so on. So we're doing a loop that contains this move. So the first time we're going to move to make this point to somewhere else. The second time we're going to move to make that somewhere else have a value that we want. And, well, how do we turn this into an actually running code? And the observation that was made here is that, oh, after this mem move was a call to stringlen. And this actually called one of those dynamic linker stubs. It called this procedure linkage table thing that looked up a global offset table entry. And conveniently, this stringlen call had a user-supplied string that we could control as the attacker, as input to this program. It passed that input to stringlen. So what's the goal going to be here? The goal is going to be to replace this global offset table entry with a pointer to that system function. So instead of getting the length of a string, it's going to execute the string as a command. So our goal is that we're going to do our first overflow to make data pointer point to the stringlen global offset table entry, and the second time this runs, it's going to overwrite that with a pointer to the system function. So step one, make data pointer point to the system function, then this runs again, and they made it point to the system stub. They didn't even find the actual system function. They just made it point to, I believe, probably system at PLT. So the key thing that confuses people here is that this is in a loop. So first time we execute the loop, we overwrite this pointer. Second time we use this, and this second time this pointer points to stringlen, and we overwrite the stringlen offset table entry. And this is all global variables. So this is not even involving the stack in any way. This is entirely a global variable memory buffer overflow. So the question is, RDI contains the string which we execute? Yeah, so I mentioned when I talked about why we would replace something with a pointer to the system function is, well, the system function executes whatever is in RDI. And the reason why that was useful here And a common pattern you would see in exploiting that sort of bug is that, well, stringlen, which triggers the call that we call that's going to happen, fills RDI for us. So we didn't have to do any extra effort to make sure RDI had the right value. The program kind of did that for free because it was setting up to call stringlen, and we just made that call to stringlen do something else. So questions about how this exploit worked? So this brings up sort of the common structure we see in, you know, when you have this sort of pointer subterfuge where you overwrite a pointer to overwrite more pointers. So, you know, the reason why it would be useful is we often have programs which sort of have these loops where you can do one iteration, you mess up the program state, the next iteration you use that mess up state to, you know, mess even more stuff up. So we have stages to actually do our exploit. But this comes up a lot with things like network programs or programs which, you know, accept commands in a loop, you know, programs which, you know, have a scripting language like a web browser. So often this is actually a sort of practical exploit strategy, is that, you know, you don't have to do the exploit all in one input, that you can, you know, do a series of inputs, you know, each one, you know, which sort of advances another step. So I showed you sort of the sketch of this exploit. So in reality, you know, it wasn't quite this simple. So there were some additional mitigations, like something needed to be done about ASLR. They need to deal with not being able to write null characters, which is kind of annoying for filling this in probably, but turned out to be something you could deal with. And the bug, you know, was actually a bit tricky. That often it's the case, and something we'll often omit, is that, well, you know, making this length here be too big, it doesn't happen for free. There's, you know, some bug you have to trigger by just having, you know, exactly the right commands being sent, which is why, you know, it wasn't obvious to the writers of NTPD that there was a problem. Okay, so let's do, since we've seen an example of this pointer subterfuge, let's do a little exercise here. So let's say here I have a struct with a pointer to another struct, and I can first set this email with overflowing the email struct into this array of pointers. And secondly, I can use the first element of that array of pointers to write to the regrade request item. So the idea is that if we controlled string 1 and string 2, you know, how would we use this to do this overwrite this address to this value? So the first string is going to control what goes in this assignment pointer. The second string is going to control what goes based on that pointer in this regray request field. Oh, I should emphasize for clarity that I'm drawing this so this is increasing addresses go down. Give another 20 seconds or so. So what we want to think about is, so probably the trickiest thing here is that our pointer, our first pointer that we're setting, you know, it points to the beginning of this assignment struct, but that's not where we actually end up writing. We don't write to the beginning of it. That's sort of the trickiest thing to deal with. And that's something which often comes up when these vulnerabilities appear in practice, is that you'll have a pointer to some data structure, and the thing you can write to that data structure doesn't write to the beginning of it. Okay, so most of you wanted to... So the most popular answer was having it point to directly where we wanted to overwrite. But the problem is that, you know, we're going to overwrite that if this, say, points to, I'll should use a different color. So if this here, let's say this is 1000, then the address we're going to overwrite is going to be OX 1000 plus 128. Why plus 128? Because we're not going to overwrite the buffer at the first 128 bytes. We're going to overwrite something that starts after that. So what we act, so to overwrite 1000, what we actually want would want is to over to write 1000 minus 128. So we end up overwriting OX 1000. Applying that to our actual target here, we want to overwrite this value minus 128. You know, that's the value we want in this pointer here. And we want to set it to the actual pointer, which I believe, no. And you, which is, and set it to the actual pointer, which remember is going to start at these right at the beginning of this regrow request string. So this regrow request string starts 128 bytes into the struct, and we can just put the pointer right there because that's where, you know, that's going to be the right place in memory. We don't need any extra stuff to make that work because this pointer here, when the string copy happens, already points to where we want it to, doesn't actually point to a real buffer. So questions about how I came up with this answer? I would expect, given that we definitely did not have consensus about it. So the question is, what? Can I explain the minus 128 again? So the first write is going to overwrite this pointer here. And when this pointer is used, if the pointer, say, points to address 1000, we're not going to write to 1000 in this add regrade request call because when that the thing at 1000 is the submission file. So we're going to go skip ahead 128 bytes and write to the regrade request field. So because of that, the actual location that this writes is not where the pointer points, but 128 bytes later. And we need to compensate for that when we set up the pointer that we want to overwrite something in particular. So that means our correct answers here were that this should be our string one should be 0x1020304050 minus 128 after 128 bytes of stuff, bytes in buffer, that 128 being the size of the email field, and this should be as is.
Why is the second field as is?
So the question is, why is it as is? Because if we've set the first field correctly, then the address computed here for the first argument to string copy will be this pointer. So our goal is that this string copy here, this first argument, is computed to be this address. And if we've done that, then we just want to put the value that we want at that address. So we just need that value represented as a string. So question, why not plus 128? So, you know, doesn't regrade request mean we should point to the start of a struct? So we want to pretend we have a struct such that the regrade request part of the struct is at this location. So one way of thinking about it is that, you know, if the middle of the struct has our regrade request object, and that's going to be at this 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 location, but we have to give a pointer to the beginning of this fake struct. And that's why we end up subtracting. So a way you can kind of think about it is you can draw the place you want to overwrite, and like you want to overlay a struct over there such that the part of the struct you're accessing is in the right place. That might be a more helpful way of thinking about it as far as how we set up this sort of exploit. Other questions? Okay, so let's go to talk about overflows in the heap. So far we've looked at overflows in the stack, overflows in global variables, but overflows on the heap are something we kind of haven't really looked at much. Now, some cases we've kind of already seen how to handle that. If we have a struct that contains like a function pointer after a buffer, well, that's easy. We just There's a function pointer you can overwrite. But often, we don't have that, and it seems like, oh, we're going to have trouble. But typically, on the heap, we have multiple things that were allocated with new or malloc, and they're often near each other on the heap. So let's say this is what happens when we have these two V objects here, which have a V table. Well, it might be the case that they're next to each other. In fact, will very often be the case because of how new would work. New, why wouldn't it give you the next address? That's the simplest implementation. And that means if we overwrite the end of the first buffer, we'll get to the second object. And can overwrite its V table that way. So questions about how this would happen? Now, this is something we can definitely exploit pretty well. This is a very common type of buffer overflows that will have a buffer overflow where we'll go over the end of one object allocated on the heap into whatever's next. And to actually make this work, we kind of need to figure out, oh, what's actually next to it on the heap? How would you do that? One way is like you do the overflow and you see what crashes in a debugger. Would be one example, and then you try to work with that. Now, something else that we'll talk about later is that malloc, new, free, and delete have to keep their info, and sometimes what will actually be adjacent to your object is bookkeeping information for malloc and free. So it might be the case that we have our first V table, our for buffer, and we'll have new bookkeeping stuff. So a special topic we'll talk about later is sometimes there's sort of systematic things we can do with that by overwriting that bookkeeping stuff that will let us find a pointer overwrite. But basically there's often going to be pointers in here, and we can use that pointer subterfuge technique. And like stack smashing, if we can do this, this is something that will kind of always work as long as we're using that particular implementation of new. So we'll get to that probably, in several days. But first, have some topics on, well, can we do things about this? So it seems like kind of a problem that we've actually allocated these two objects next to each other. Do we really have to do that? And to think about that, we're going to look at sort of how memory is allocated. And you may or may not have seen this in a prior course, but on modern systems, when we run two programs next to each other, well, we need a way of making them share some actual memory. And as we've kind of seen, the programs can kind of dictate what addresses they see, but if they're both loaded into the real memory at the same time, they have to turn into different addresses in the real memory. And the way that works is the OS sets a mapping. And the form of that mapping is going to matter a little bit for this class. And typically that mapping is what's known as a page table, where we divide up the addresses into these ranges called pages, which are typically of a fixed size, typically 4 kilobytes these days. And the OS will have a table for every possible page. How this table is represented, we won't talk about in detail, but we'll care about what fields are there, and the table will include information about what's the real address, if there is one, is it readable or writable, and so on. And this table is something that will be read by the hardware. So to make a program so we can, have its code, say at this address, we set that as readable and map it to a real address and so on. And whenever the program, say, accesses address 401, 401234, well, that's going to use this entry of the table, going to go to this address. And if we're trying to write, it's going to not work. So questions about sort of the high level idea of what this table means. So we look up the program address and find out where it actually goes in memory and also whether we should allow reading or writing. And this is a feature the hardware implements. So this is how, you know, the OS can allocate memory to programs. And this is something we can take advantage of to maybe make this not work, that these don't have to be next to each other in memory, and we can put something in between objects that I'll call a guard page. That if we allocate some big amount of memory, I can put a page where the table entry here is going to be, you know, no, that you can't read or write it. And I can deliberately put that in between my two objects. So now you can't actually overwrite from one object to another. This is something we can do, and this is, you know, practical to implement. And here, what I've done in this arrangement is I said, okay, we're allocating a 6,000 byte object or a 6,000 byte char array. I'll make sure you can't overflow from it to something else I'll just place it at the end of a page. So if you go over by one byte, you'll get access to something that's not readable and your program will crash right away rather than overwriting some important pointer that might be like here. So questions about this guard page idea? So there's one question related to this, which we'll get to later, is there an execute permission flag for pages two? Yes, and we'll talk about that later. But for now, we're just thinking about read or write. So a question, isn't this expensive? So sometimes, yes. And the issue is that, well, we're wasting space. One thought you might have is, well, how expensive is it? So let's do that exercise. So we're going to try to do this thing where we just say, okay, we're going to prevent overflow by allocating this guard page. And when we do that, we're going to allocate some extra space. So this is our main concern here, is that we have this unused space that we can't really use in order to, you know, make sure that, you know, we have this guard page. And question, aren't we not really wasting space, though, because you don't have that page point to actual physical memory? Let's work through this exercise here. Now, let's say we want to do this guard page idea for everything. And where it gets tricky is when we think about these small allocations. If I have a 100-byte object, what I want to do is I want to put the object and an unallocated space page. And the problem is that if I want to arrange the object like this, I need to have, you know, I need to give the object basically a whole page. And remember, we allocate, you know, this is the minimum unit we can allocate. We can allocate or mark as you know, not writable. So our big problem here is that I thought I had extra questions on this one. Or maybe I split it up into pieces. So if we only do it for these large objects, it's pretty fine. But if we do it for everything, that's where it starts getting really expensive. I thought I asked all of these questions on the quiz I entered into Zoom, but apparently that wasn't the case. How did that happen? I just didn't make copies of the question. Okay. Good work. don't have to do that. So, I guess we are on time. So most of you have inferred for 4,096 bytes. We don't need that much space. So what is going to happen here is that to do these, each of these 10,000 byte objects, we're going to end up with, we're going to have 4K, 4K, 4K allocated, because we have to do 4K chunks. And then we're going to have our guard page. And so we're going to put our 10,000 byte object, this is our 10K object, but we're going to have some wasted space because we lined up the object against the guard page. And we can't put another object there because we want it to also be lined up against the guard page, not against this other buffer. So we're going to have our wasted space of about 2K per object, which gives us about 200 kilobytes wasted. Where if we weren't doing this guard page thing, well, we could fit in some of these objects or some of these objects in this space I've put in orange here. And things are going to get worse as we include smaller objects. So if we include these 1,000 byte objects, we're going to add an extra 3K times 1,000 bytes of wasted space because we're going to allocate 4K, line up our 1,000 byte object against the guard page, you know, that unallocated memory region, and we don't have 3K we can't really use. So that's a whole bunch of extra space. And we do it for the 1,000 byte, 100 byte objects, we're going to end up with, you know, almost 4K times 100,000. So this strategy of adding guard pages, it's pretty okay for large allocations, but it's not so great for small allocations. Now, there have been programs which did this, including one of the earliest sort of buffer overflow detectors was something known as Electric Fence, which was basically just a version of malloc, which did this for all allocations. But real malloc and new implementations typically only do this for large allocations because it wastes a lot of space for small allocations. And also because it's slower, that it turns out to do this, you need to talk to the OS a bunch, whereas a typical malloc or new implementation will avoid doing that for most small allocations. So, question on my thoughts on overhead and when you would or would not do this. So the question is, does the guard page not cost any memory? Yes. So the guard page, it has some cost in that it's an entry in this table, but that's it. Since we don't specify a real address, it's just a table entry. That's the only actual memory, real memory allocated to it. So a question, can you force malloc to always use guard pages? You would probably need to switch to a different version of malloc, which you could do, but would be atypical. So question is, why bother with a table entry? So to talk about that, we need to talk about how these tables are structured. It's basically going to depend on what's around it, whether or not you can not have that table entry there. And that has to do with how the hardware implements the table lookup. Other questions? Okay, so I guess that's where we're going to leave off today. And next time we'll talk about what are other things we can do with this permission flag, and also, you know, don't we have an exec here, and how is that useful? I'll take questions before I sign off. But
yeah, sorry, could you go back to the minus 128 slide? I was still a little confused in that one.
Sure. So, where did I put that slide? It's way back here. Okay. tonight? Here, okay, there we are. Right.
Okay, yeah, so I'm just confused on, I know you're overwriting assignment in McZero to point to somewhere else, but where are you trying to point to and what exactly is trying to be accomplished?
So I'm trying to make the, so basically I want to pretend there's a struct, assignment struct there, assignment struct such that regrade request is at this location. Now, there isn't really an assignment struct there, right? There's just some random memory values there. But to make, pretend that there's a regrade request at that offset, I need to pretend that submission file is at an earlier address.
Okay.
So I'm going to, and that's because that's what the first thing in assignment is. That's what this pointer actually needs to point to, is where the submission file buffer is. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to point before where I went overwritten and hope that the program doesn't notice, and indeed we don't see any code which would, that submission file contains junk.
Okay, and so the arrow to regrade request, does that like tell the compiler to skip 128 bytes to look for the regrade request array?
The question, yeah, this arrow, yes, that tells the compiler, you know, look for this field of the struct. The compiler knows how big, how the struct is laid out, so it's going to skip 128 bytes ahead.
Okay, and are we just pointing to some like arbitrary code that we want to execute?
So in this case, I haven't told you why we wanted to do this overwrite. But if this was sort of trying to point to code, like then this would be the address of a function pointer, and this would be the address of the code we wanted to run.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks, appreciate it.
And a question, so a guard page doesn't take up a whole page's worth of memory? That is correct. Okay. Anything else?